Okay, Boker Tov. Hope everybody is doing well and enjoying the weather's getting okay. We'll wait for a moment. The weather's getting a little nicer. I was out for a walk yesterday, and tons of people riding their bikes and whatever. It's nice. I can please go. We can go for walks wherever we want, you know, soon. Okay, last week we left off. I said we had a machloket. If machloket is a good thing, we saw there are two main sources in our tradition in the Talmud whether disputes are good or bad. That we said this because we're going to start now the period of Zugot in Pirkei Avot. We're going through the history of the transmission of our Torah. So we have what's in Tanakh, Moshe to the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. Then we have Shimon HaTzadik, the last of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. Then his student, Antignos Isocho. And then we start no longer Shimon and Antignos, but it's two people. And this was, we know, recorded in rabbinic literature, the first dispute in Jewish history arose during the beginning of the Second Temple period. In the First Temple period, I assume there were disputes, but they were easily resolved. Whatever they said, the first one, and it was on a temple issue. There are always, religion is always a major issue of dispute. That's like for good and bad, as we'll see. And the dispute, as we mentioned last week, was whether you can lean on an animal, sort of an archaic, arcane point in when you bring a sacrifice, the person bringing the sacrifice had to put his hands, what we call smicha, had to put his hands on the animal. The question was, could you do that on Yontif? But so we discussed the one source that says that it used to be whenever there was a dispute in Jewish law, you would go to the local rabbi, the local courts. If they weren't sure, you'd go to the higher courts all the way, like in any country. And if need be, a complicated question, the Supreme Court, the Sanhedrin, would rule on it. But when the students of Hillel and Shammai, Shelo Shimshutz Rebbeim Kotzorcham, when the students of Shammai and Hillel came, and they weren't so meticulous, they didn't listen so carefully, they were Shelo Shimshutz, they didn't service their teachers, Hillel and Shammai, so much, there came a lot of disputes in Israel, and I believe there are about 350 disputes recorded in the Talmud between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, almost on every page. Kimat, that's an exaggeration, but all over the place, well over 300 arguments. So, v'naset Torah k'shtei Torah, it became like two different Torahs. You have the Torah of Hillel and the Torah of Shammai, and they argue on everything. How to say Kiddush, how to do anything, how to light Hanukkah candles, they're arguing all over the place. That's one source, which gives a very negative picture of Machloket. And the other source that we began to discuss, perhaps a more famous source, that the Talmud says for 3 years, Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai argued. Each one said, the halacha is like me, and the halacha is like me, the halacha is like everybody always says that. And what happened is a bat kol, a heavenly voice came out and said, they're both right. Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim chayim. They both represent the word of the living God. They both interpretations are correct. You have to discuss what that means exactly. But halacha ke Beit Hillel. It's very nice in theory. In theory, they're both right, but in practice, you have to choose what you're going to do. So these sources seem to contradict. That's where we left off last week. So we discuss, is it good or bad? Are these sources in contradiction? I will say, I think like many, as a matter of fact, Rabbi Schaffner last night in his Parshat HaShavuah here mentioned that when we deal with these sort of meta issues, what's holiness? He was discussing, he discussed, he sort of alluded to the machloket, the Rambam and the Ramban, is it a good thing to be a Nazir? To separate yourself, become an ascetic. So the Ramban says, yeah, that's a wonderful thing. If you can do it, it's holy, it's wonderful. And the Rambam says, it's very negative. Why does a person have to withdraw? We have enough prohibitions in Torah. Why do you say you have to, you can't drink wine anymore? So there's a fundamental dispute, really. It's a fundamental dispute of what our attitude is towards you know, pleasure and enjoyment. And he made an interesting comment that he finds on all these sort of overarching meta-halakha issues that the Talmud always will present various views. There's never one view on this issue, because there isn't a view. So I think it's the same way. Is machloket, is disputes good or bad? I think it depends. There is a time, and the reason the Talmud is presenting these two different sources, and they're both about Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. It's not like two different people arguing. Both one of them says the students of Hillel and Shammai didn't properly service their teachers, and therefore the Torah split into two. And one says they're both the words of the living God. So they're both true. We have to live with the contradiction. Beit HaShammai and Shammai is not one person. It's hundreds of people over 100 years. So it is possible some machlokas are good and some aren't good. So I just want to spend a few minutes on this issue. When is machlokas perhaps to, there is, different attitudes, but what to sort of say, what's the sort of the classical view on when is machloket a good thing? So later on in Pirkei Avot, maybe please God in a few years, we keep going, we'll get there in the fifth chapter. We know that the Mishnah says, Kol machloket shehi l'shem shemayim, sofa lehi kayem. Any argument that is for the sake of heaven, you have to define that too. Any argument that's for the sake of heaven will have a sofali kayem. It's a little bit hard to translate. In the end, it will have, permanence. In other words, something positive will come out of this dispute. Not for the sake of heaven, ain't sofali kayem. Won't have anything good, won't have something positive. And then what's the dispute? What's the dispute between shemachloket l'shem shemayim? Anybody wanna chime in? Because what's the example the Mishnah gives of a dispute between L'shem Shemayim? Nobody wants to chime in, so I'll chime in. The Mishnah says, "Zumachloket Hillel v'Shammai." This is a dispute between Hillel and Shammai, and a machloket shelo l'shem Shemayim is Korach v'Chol Adato. Both of those examples are illuminating. Korach v'Chol Adato. Of course, we know what do you mean Korach v'Chol Adato. Who is the dispute? Dispute between Korach and Moshe. In other words, a machloket. Korach was disputing Moshe, and the Mishnah is very careful. It doesn't say Korach and Moshe. It says Korach and his helpers, Datan and Aviram, the 250 people who came with him, because Moshe really was L'shem Shemayim. It was he wasn't the Vavshalo L'shem Shemayim, and we know the classical commentaries explain usually when people are fighting for the wrong reasons, they want to take over. So among themselves, they all fight, and that's the famous Medrash about On Ben Pelet, that his wife said, well, what are you getting involved for, right? He was at the beginning of the dispute, then we never hear from him again. So the Medrash says that on Ben Pelet, his wife said, you're crazy. If Moshe wins, you're going to get killed for being on the wrong side. The earth will swallow you up too, so to speak. And if you guys win, so what? So you'll be a henchman. You'll be, the eighth in command onto Korach. You're going to lose anyway. So don't go into disputes. Usually the rebels are fighting among themselves. But that's Korach v'chol adato. Korach, everybody had their own reason. They argued among themselves. But Hillel and Shammai is a fascinating thing. So some of the commentaries actually point out, based on the source, that machloket began because the students of Hillel and Shammai did not properly service their teachers and not properly pay attention, that some want to point out that the Mishnah is exact. Hillel and Shammai are L'shem Shammai, but Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai is not L'shem Shammai. Hillel and Shammai, we know, only had three or five. Their three major disputes are the first three Mishnayot in Masechet Ediot. I think I mentioned that a couple of weeks ago, the first Mishnah ever recorded, the testimonies from of early rabbinic history, and there are three arguments, and there later on, that's it. And then the Mishnah lists off cases where Beit Hillel agreed with Beit Shammai. Hillel and Shammai argued very little, three arguments. Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai argued a lot. So some commentaries point out Hillel and Shammai is for the sake of heaven, but not Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. Now that's a scary thought for us. If Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai don't even reach the level of an argument for the sake of heaven, what does it say about all arguments? And I'll just make a comment. When I was in Rav Schachter's year, he mentioned, and I don't remember in whose name he quoted it, but he mentioned some prominent rabbinic figure who mentioned that there has not been a machloka. I guess it was sort of a remark. There has not been a machloka l'shem shemayim in 500 years. I don't know why he said 500 and not 1,000 or 1,500 years. In other words, everybody assumes they're always arguing for the sake of heaven. It's not so easy to argue for the sake of heaven. And it's always best to avoid machloket, but we'll come when it might be good. There's a story of Rav Chaim of Elazhin. Rav Chaim of Elazhin was the The top student of the Vilna Gaon died in 1821, the founder of the great yeshiva in Voloshin in 1803. The Vilna Gaon died in 1797. The Vilna Gaon sent most of his top students to go to Israel, and that's where they went. And then he told Rav Chaim, his top student, to stay behind and establish a yeshiva, and Voloshin became the mother of all yeshivas, so to speak. So Rav Chaim of Voloshin, there was once a major argument going on. There are always major arguments, like I said, especially on religious issues. And they asked him, and he refused to get involved in the argument. Like Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was like that. Great, Rav Moshe Feinstein was like that. The people, they didn't get involved in Machloket. They stayed above the fray. They got along with everybody. And they asked him why he doesn't express his opinion. So he said, listen, they're arguing about what they're arguing about is a rabbinic issue. You know, do you say Tachnun and Shul? That's not even a rabbinic issue. We argue on silly things. The argument they're having, it's the worst thing that can happen is you violate a rabbinic prohibition. But a machloket, shelo l'shem shamayim, that's a biblical prohibition. It says in the Torah, v'lo kiyek k'korach u'chol adato, one shouldn't follow in the pathways of Korach. And some of the people who count the 613 mitzvot count that as one of the 613 mitzvot, not to create disputes. So he says, I would prefer to avoid a dispute because that's perhaps I'll get involved in the biblical prohibition. So I'll do a rabbinic mitzvah, not correctly. That doesn't bother him as much. So that's on the one hand. You have to be very, very careful. You know, maybe even Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. So what do you do? So how does Elu ve'Elu Divrei Elohim Chayim work? How does the other side? And you know, there's machloket on every page of the Gemara. Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, that's only one generation. They have 350 arguments, you know. What about Rav and Shmuel? Abayi and Rav, the study of Talmud, you know, the terminology used for someone who studies Talmud is Habayot Abayi v'Rava. One who focuses on the disputes of Abaye and Rava. So the Gemara does have this concept of Elu v'Elu. These and those are the words of the living God. And the way it's generally assumed is the Torah, most areas in life are gray. And so some people see it's 60% kosher and some people see it's 60% not kosher. It's a little bit, it's got elements of yes and no. And depending on your perspective, you see it differently. I remember Rav Schachter also explained that, you know, two people look at a room, and depending on where you're sitting in the room or where you're looking from, you see the room differently. What you're both seeing is correct, but are you looking at it from this angle or that angle? And depending on how you see it, you're going to have a different perspective. So that's how halakha works. Halakha, by nature, is gray. Throughout Jewish history, there's always been disputes, if I can use that word, machloket, like, is it good to codify Jewish law? Many of the greatest figures, basically all codification of Jewish law took place in the Sephardic world. Ashkenazic Jewry never codified. I'm talking now until before the modern period. In other words, Rashi, Tosfot, the Maram of Rutenberg, they didn't write any codes. Tosafot, his comments on Talmud, is not a code. He'll present four different opinions. He doesn't tell you what the law is. All of codification, the Rambam, of course, the most famous, the Rif, the Rambam, the Tur, all were living in Sephardic countries. And lots of people were against codification because halacha doesn't work that way. We don't codify halacha. Every rabbi in every generation has the right and the obligation to rule based on how he understands the development of Jewish law from the Talmud up to his time. And that's the way it theoretically works. The problem is it's very hard in practice, what you have to know and the analysis. So there's always this back and forth between codification and not. And all the codes were disputes when they were written, should they be accepted? On a practical level, we all know that we need them because otherwise, you know, it's impossible to it would be too hard. So codification, and in today's world, everything. We have books in English, 500 pages on Spiros Omer. Every little subject gets hundreds of books. But this is a new thing. But Eli Bailey, we have different opinions, you can. But so when can you say Elu v'Elu? When you have these two different ways of looking at something, and everybody, depending, like I said, depending on their perspective, where they're coming from, because the halakha allows for a multiplicity of views, and it encourages, because that's the way the halakha develops, and that's halakha remains relevant. Once you codify something in writing, it becomes much harder. That's what we have today. It becomes very hard to change something, and that's why this. I alluded to this, I think, a couple weeks ago. That's why there's sort of this ambivalence. Because we want to have the flexibility, and because the halakhic system is built that way. The halakhic system is Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim im chayim, that Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai both can be right. They're, one's looking at the room like this, one's looking at the room like that, because the halakha is not clear-cut, because halakha is multifaceted. Just like a Supreme Court decision, there are reasons to say A, reasons to B. The Ramban, in his introduction to the Milchamot, has a fascinating comment. The Ramban, you know, I'll quote the Ramban as, the second most important commentary on the Bible after Rashi. The Ramban was an amazing person. He was a philosopher. He was a great commentary, of course, on the Chumash, a great commentary on the Talmud. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein and was asked, they have I don't know if anybody have seen the book, I highly recommend it. He was interviewed a couple of years before he passed away. Rav Chaim Sabato, who's one of the Rosh Yeshivas in Mali Adumim, interviewed Rav Lichtenstein 20 weeks. He went to Rav Lichtenstein's house 20 weeks in a row, and every week he interviewed him on another topic. And he published the book initially in Hebrew, and then it's in English. I happen to have it in English and in Hebrew. But it's fascinating. Just talking about Rav Aaron, about all modern issues, and you know, one of the famous things he asked him is, what did you learn at Harvard? When he went to Harvard, he said, life is complex. In 4 years in Harvard, he learned life is complex. It's a beautiful, important statement. But he asked Rav Lichtenstein, if you were stuck on a desert island, and you could only take one book with you, what would it be? And Rav Lichtenstein said, the Ramban's commentary on Chumash, which was, as a Brisker, the Ramban, that's, he said, the most, the book he would take with him, he could only have one book, is the Ramban. The Ramban, is the great defender of people in Jewish history. When the dispute, the Ramban is born in 1194. The dispute of the Rambam really breaks out in the open 1232. The Rambam dies in 1204. It's the generation afterwards, when his works gets translated into Arabic, that people read the Rambam and flip out. They say, this guy's a heretic, and they burn his books and all kinds of things. And the Ramban didn't like a lot of what the Rambam did. The Ramban feels some of the Rambam's comments did border on heresy, but he also understood the greatness of the Rambam. The Rambam tried to bring peace, and he defends, that's his role. So he has a second person he makes peace with, and that is the commentary of the Rif. The Rif was the first code really written in Jewish law. He wrote it on the pages of the Talmud, and the Baal HaMa'or, Rav Zerachya Halevi, I wrote a very sharp attack. I mean, sharp attack. He was great, but he wrote critical comments. And the Ramban, in his book called Milchamot Hashem, The Wars of the Lord, that name is such a powerful name, comes to the defense of the Rif. And often he'll say, like the Rambam says, you know, the Rambam will say, I don't agree with the Rambam here. I agree with his critics. However, I'll tell you how to defend the Rambam. Which is also a beautiful idea. I don't have to agree, but I can see the correctness of your position. Anyway, why am I mentioning all this? So the Ramban, in his introduction to the Milchamot, writes that Talmudic logic and Jewish law is not like mathematics. In mathematics, you can prove, and maybe in theoretically you can prove it, 2 + 2 = 4. Everything is formulas. Everything is, can be shown what the theory is, how it works, and you can prove things. That's how the scientific method works. It says halakha is not a science, it's an art. You can never prove things. You can never give a 100% slam dunk answer that my position is right. The halakha has a built-in ambiguity, and that allows for different opinions, that allows the development of halakha. So that's an important, that's the other side, when machloket is good. So just to give three things, then I want to move on back to the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, I would say the three areas that turn a machloket into something that is l'shem shemayim, number one, if they're arguing about ideas, arguing about how to understand something. Rashi, in Ksuvot, says that you don't say, this is obvious, but maybe today it has to be pointed out, you do not say these, like when two rabbis are arguing, you don't say they're both right if they're arguing on facts. If they're arguing on ideas, in other words, Rashi said, this one says he said this, this one said like this. You can't have, the facts are the facts, right? So you're entitled to your own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. So Elu Velu never applies when people are arguing on a scientific thing. Either it's true or it isn't true. We may not know, but if they're arguing on historical, if they're arguing on Girsus of the Gemara, the Vilna Gaon, this song is very not in style anymore, or usually hasn't been in style. To get proper text of our great source, actually, there is some work being done on that nowadays. Because before the invention of the printing press, and even with, and who would copy books? You'd get a minimum wage worker. We know what it is to be a minimum wage worker today. So they got some on minimum wage, and they made mistakes, even if they got some paid a lot of money. So how can you copy the entire Talmud and not make mistakes? So mistakes have crept in to all our sources. So today you want to go to manuscripts. So generally, that was the big dispute. What do? You find new manuscripts. So there is a position, the Chazon Ish most famously, we reject manuscripts. We don't care because God's hand was it not to have that. And we live with the mistakes and the mistakes get incorporated. And there are many examples in Halakha that we do Halakhot that mistakes. Probably Magdil the Migdol on Shabbos benching is probably one example. It's based on mistakes and manuscripts and writing down things. And but there are other approaches. We have to change things. We have to update things. Rav Avadji Yosef felt like that. If you find a manuscript in the Rambam says the opposite of what we think he said, and we know that's the true manuscript. Okay, so you can't say they're both right. Elu ve'elu cannot work on history. It cannot work in fact. It works on ideas. Works in interpretation. That's number one. Okay, the most important thing I would say, and the Tiferet Yisrael I think makes this comment. What's machloket l'shem shemaim? Why do they say Hillel and Shammai? Says because they had ahava and achva. Those are the words he uses. Love and friendship. The Gemara has a famous comment that even though Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel would argue about who's a mamzer and who you can marry, etc., they would marry among themselves. They were very close together and very friendly with each other. They loved each other. And so a machloket l'shem shemaim means an argument where at the end of the day, the disputants like each other more than before they argued with each other. That's what a machloket l'shem shemaim is. So you can look around the world. What happens when people argue? Do they become closer? Because if they're both searching for truth, they're going to become much closer with each other than if they are not. So that will tell you the results if machloket is l'shem shemaim, and then they have to be totally focused. Like they can't have, or they didn't pay attention. So we do have, there is room for argument, but I would say that it's hard. It's hard to really, so many of our arguments are, they get personal. It's very hard to not get personal. Idea arguments are beautiful. And to try to maintain the distinction between an idea argument and a real argument is something we should do. Okay, maybe that's a little bit too much. Let's go into the Mishnah itself. So we'll start like this. We're Perak Aleph Mishnah Dalit, Yossi ben Yoezer, Yisreida, Yossi ben Yochanan, Ish Yerushalayim ki blu mehem. They received from them. Yossi ben Yoezer Amer Yi Beitcha Beit Vad Lechachamim. Your home should be a Beit Vad Lechachamim. A Beit Vad means a meeting place. A Moed, the Ol Moed was where God met Moshe. A Moed, our holidays are called Moed. A Moed is where basically God and the Jewish people meet in history. We come to meet a Beit Vad, an Ol Moed, so that's the meeting place. So your home should be open to sages. You should welcome in scholars, and the commentaries point out, because we all know this instinctively, I think, you learn more from the casual interaction with great people than attending a lecture they give. Attending a lecture is very nice, going to shir, but as the Talmud says, gadol shimusha yoter min limudat, the service. A scholar to schmooze with him at the dinner table, to take him to the airport, you learn a lot more to see how people interact. So open your house to people, and that's even more important than going to learn with the people. That's how it's normally understood. They meet abek bafar reglayem, come to their... the dust of their feet. Attach yourself to the dust of the feet. So this, the commentaries explain that when they used to learn Torah, they didn't have nice floors the way we do. They would learn out in the field, whatever, in Karen Vyavna, out in the field. And they would sit on the ground, and the teacher would sit on a sort of on a stool, and they would be literally on the ground. But it that's the simple idea. But of course, when it means afar reik lehem, afar in biblical imagery means to be humble, afar, the dust of the earth. The Jewish people are compared to afar and the stars in the sky. So it depends how we act. Are we, but afar means a sense of humility, that when you learn, you have to have a sense of humility. And the truth of the matter is, that's why the Talmud says we follow Beit Hillel. I don't think I ever explained that. I said the machlok, in other words, the heavenly voice came out and said we follow Beit Hillel. Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel are both right. Why do we follow Beit Hillel? So the Gemara says because Beit Hillel was more humble. It's an unbelievable thing. They were more humble than Beit Shammai. They would always quote Beit Shammai first, and they would always be open to other opinions. And it's not just a reward for being nice, that we reward you. It's people who are humble are less likely to make a mistake. People who have less humility are more convinced of the rightness of their ways. So being humble, even if you're not as great a scholar, and the Talmud makes it very clear that Beit Shammai were sharper than Beit Hillel. The best of the best were Beit Shammai, and Beit Hillel was very, very good. But the Beit Shammai are Harif Beit Tvei. They were sharper, they were better, but sometimes you're too smart for yourself. So being humble is a key ingredient to being accepted as the halakhic authority. That's why I accept Beit Hillel. It's a key development in learning, and of course, it's the only attribute that Moshe Rabbeinu was described as having. He was the most humble of all people. Humble doesn't mean you're not aware of your greatness. It just means you put it in proper perspective and you use it. So having mitavek b'afar reik lehem, a student has to be a little bit humble. A student can challenge, is obligated to challenge your teacher. I remember Rabbi Soloveitchik saying, it's very actually important point, that Rabbi Soloveitchik said, you should never follow a teaching of your teacher, a ruling, if you don't understand it. In other words, very often it's sort of the anti-dat Torah view. You know, you ask whatever the rabbi says, I just tell me yes or no. So Rabbi Soloveitchik said, you know, your rabbi gives you an explanation, and it doesn't make sense to you, and you can't understand it. So Rabbi Soloveitchik said you shouldn't follow it. We don't follow something. It has to make sense. It has to make sense. Could be for him, for your teacher, it makes sense. For you, it doesn't make sense. So on the one hand, you have to challenge. That's always the way. It's like students challenge their teachers, but we also have to be humble. And we have to know our place. That's Evi Mitapek, Baruch Lehem, Evi Shotev, et Sama, et Ivrahim. And you should drink. You're very thirsty. The words of your sages, you should drink like you're very thirsty. You should love to the words of what wise people say. We're talking about the Chachamim, which, and by the way, in general, the term Chacham is a reference to all knowledge, not only Torah knowledge. The Talmud says if there's a Torah is Torah, and Chokhmah is wisdom, is general wisdom, like Torah Mada, Torah Chokhmah. So the term Chachama, the Talmud says, if they say there's Chachmah Bagoyim, there's wisdom in the nations, of course, believe them, it's true. So when he says, it doesn't only mean Torah scholars. It also means like Torah scholars, but it means all wise people. You want to have a house that is full of wisdom. You want to be humble before them, know who you are, you know, great people, and listen to their words very carefully, and then you can, move on. So that's Yossi ben Yoezer. Now, Yossi ben Yochanan, Ish Yerushalayim, a fascinating name. Yossi ben Yochanan, the man of Jerusalem, we mentioned, Ish means the most important person. So to be the most important, the great leader of Jerusalem, Yossi ben Yochanan. So he has a slightly different approach. Your home should be open wide. So whereas Yossi ben Yoezer focused on a scholarship, on learning, Yossi ben Yochanan focuses on the average person. And that's always, again, the sort of the elite and the average person. Generally, we focus on the elite. When we study Jewish history, we study, the great people. To study how the average person lives perhaps is more instructive and more important. The Torah was given to everybody. Atem nitzavim hayom kochem, from the water carrier and the wood chopper. Torah is not the exclusive domain. This is also a theme Rabbi Soloveitchik developed very often. Torah is not just for Torah scholars. We get that approach very often. We get that feeling. But Torah is for the simple person. And so Yossi ben Yochanan says, open up your house not just to Torah scholars. Open up your house to everybody. Now, of course, he's Ish Yerushalayim. He's living in Jerusalem. And if you're living in Jerusalem, there are always people who are traveling through Jerusalem, because people were coming there three times a year in theory to come for Ola Rego. People were coming for Korbanot. It's the capital of the country. So you had, there were always people there. So it was very important that people be hospitable more in Jerusalem. There, I think there's that added aspect. And he says, you should welcome in the poor. People are very happy to welcome in fancy people and scholars and wealthy people, but to welcome the poor people, that we're much less prone to do. So that's what he's emphasizing. The poor should also be part of your home. Some of the commentaries fascinatingly explain that it means you should make an extra effort when you hire people, to hire people who need the money much more. In other words, people who are poor, you should, the anim should be, if you're very wealthy and you can hire help, not your friend, not the, for the summer job, not your friend's son, whatever. I mean, hire the person who can't pay to go to university, who needs the job a lot more. That's an interesting idea. You aniim b'nei beitecha, the people who you bring into your house, so to speak, either literally or figuratively, should be focused on the poor. And then I'll say the third thing, it's always a difficult idea. How do we explain this in the modern time? But that's fine. We'll try to do it unapologetically. But al tarbe sivcha im ha'isha. Do not have a lot of discussion with the wife, with the woman, ha'isha. And okay, that's what he says. Now, just the Mishnah then makes a comment, very like an editorial comment. It's all the commentators point out. You'll notice that every single teacher in Pirkei Avot, in the first chapter, says three things, right? Anshei Knesset Agdola, three things. Heim Amru Shlosha Dvarim. Rabbi Shimon, Shimon HaTzadik, Al Shlosha Dvarim Halam Amed. Antigonus Yisocho, each one of the sages are saying three things. That's a three. Three is an important number, I guess. Obviously, they had a lot to say, but every person who's quoted in the first chapter, Hillel, Shammai, three things. Later on, we'll quote additional things from Hillel. And the second and the third chapter of Pirkei Avot begin, look at three things and you won't sin, right? He stuck up a shloshet varim elu below bali de avera. So it's interesting, the number three. So Yossi ben Yochanan also says three things. Your home should be open wide and to the poor. That's interesting. That's sort of two separate things. Both your home should be open to everybody, not just scholars, and then your home should be especially open to the poor. And then, and perhaps it's connected, if you're inviting all these strangers into your house, maybe it's not, altar besichaim ha'isha, do not talk too much to women. That doesn't mean you can't talk at all, but altar besichaim ha'isha, because it could lead to immorality. That was clearly, there's undoubtedly that, I mean, it's of course, it's true all the time. But in the society of the time of the Mishnah, where women had a much more secondary role than they do today, so that was a fear of the rabbis had. Altar besichaim ha'isha. It was interesting. I was looking up. I was just curious. Rabbi Gitz Greenberg, I'm sure many of you know of. He wrote a book last year on Pirkei Avot. So I was looking through it just now. So I said what he wrote. So he just sort of sidesteps the whole issue, and he said, in the time of the Mishnah, the great fear of the rabbis was immorality, was sexual immorality. And today we live in a society where women are have leadership roles in so many areas. And therefore, it's a totally different society. So obviously, we can't apply this Mishnah literally. And then our challenge really, how do we incorporate women within society with keeping our moral, strictures? Since the status of women has changed, okay, very nice. Now, how are we going to work that in to make sure that the sexual guard doesn't go down. Obviously, this is still a problem, and anybody who denies that has their head in the sand. So the Mishnah was obviously concerned about this issue. Some of the commentaries point out, I don't know, the word sicha means sort of a idle conversation. I don't have to tell you, and that's why I said I don't want to be apologetic about it. We know that the great rabbis, many of them are very, you know, they would check with, when Rabbi Lezer ben Azariah got appointed the Nasi, we spoke about that on the first week. So when they deposed Rabbi Gamliel, so the first thing he said is he asked that, ask his wife if she should take the job. And we know that's a very common thing, but still, and some of the commentaries to link it to the previous things he said is when you're inviting guests, don't ask your wife too much. You know, like, you know, the guys they bring home, they meet somebody in shul and you bring home and your wife's not shul, you know. So on the one hand, it's not so nice. You can't just bring extra guests to the house. On the other hand, that's what some say. I don't know if it's really what it means, but I mean, that when you're bringing the poor to the house, sometimes you have to make a decision. This is the right thing to do. The assumption of the Mishnah was, of these commentaries, it was the woman around the household. And that's just the way it was. And obviously, if you're bringing in extra guests, it's more work for the woman. So she might be more opposed. So therefore, don't do it. I don't know. I don't know if that's an explanation, but that's what some say. But then what's fascinating is the Mishnah, the Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi then puts in an editorial comment. You don't have that anywhere else where somebody says, and then they comment on that. So the Mishnah says, the Ishto Amru, then Ha Isha, the woman, right? That's comes from Adam. When God asked Adam, why did you eat from the apple? He says, Ha Isha Asher Natatali, the woman you gave me. And Rashi comments, that was a lack of gratitude. The woman you gave me. God gave man, a woman, a wife, to be an Ezer Kenegdo, to be a partner. And Adam turns around and said, it's your fault, God. If you wanted to give me this partner, I wouldn't have sinned. But he says, Ha Isha, the woman who you gave to me, it's all her fault. That's what Adam said. So Alter Besichami Aisha, so the Mishnah's commenting, it doesn't mean don't talk to to woman a lot. It's talking about don't talk to your wife a lot. Alter Besichami Aisha, that's it's even way stranger, right? Otherwise, how much more so shouldn't you be marbe sicha? Shouldn't have a lot of conversation? The sages say from here, whenever a person talks too much to the woman, he'll cause bad for himself. So this is a fascinating comment that gives a new window into the Mishnah. He will nullify the words of Torah. He won't study Torah. Botel mi divrei Torah generally means the study of Torah, b'sofo yoresh gehenim, and then he'll inherit gehenim. The person's not involved in Torah. And what here the Mishnah is alluding for, and this is, I think, maybe you'll argue with me, but please feel free to argue with me, but I think it's 100% true, or 95% true, that how much a husband learns is dependent on the wife. If the wife is willing for the husband to go to a shir 2-3 nights a week, or to get up early in the morning, daf yomi, very often it's the wife who encourages the husband. I know that's, you know, that's the reality. Today we live in a society, I think, Baruch Hashem, we live in a society where sometimes the husbands have to encourage the wives to go and learn. And it's not, you know, somebody has to take care of the kids, you know, that's for sure. So, you know, I mean, whatever one thinks of women rabbis and women leadership, etc. So one of the issues they discuss is really what happens to have a one-year-old kid at home. So does that mean both the husband and wife can't go to shul? So does that mean that the husband should stay home sometimes? So that's interesting. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, the great Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, did mention that when his kids were growing up, when his kids were little, he often didn't go to minyan in the morning. That he had to take care of the kids at home, and that's more important than going to minyan. It's an important Musar Haskel for myself, for everybody, for all of us, that whatever the Mishnah means, we know in practice how much respect and honor the great rabbis had towards their wives. And it's not that Torah is the exclusive domain of men. That's not true at all. And it's for sure not true in our generation. But at the same time, I do think if men want to learn, and that's what the Mishnah is saying, if you talk too much, you go to, you know, go out every night, the movies and this, who knows what, the husband and wife have to be on the same page when they our learning Torah. Anyways, that's what he says. I guess I'd be lying a little bit. I mean, it is a little bit, that statement does make me a little uncomfortable. Okay, that's fine. I think some things of, you know, the sages do make us represent a different worldview. So you just have to, whatever, you have to figure out how do we incorporate the idea behind it with the reality that we're in, that we let, you know, men and women are have a much more equal footing than they did in the time of the Mishnah. Okay, whatever. Let's do something. Let's move on to the next Mishnah. Yeshua ben Prachya Benita or Bailey. This is the second set. This is probably the middle of the second century BCE. And this is, we'll talk maybe this Mishnah, and then we'll see how far we get. Yeshua ben Prachya Mer Asela Charav. Make for yourself a rabbi. Uknei lecha chaver, and buy for yourself a friend, vaveidana kol ha'adam lekavzchud, and judge the person to merit. To merit. So, okay, these are all a famous, you know, teaching. Let's see, hopefully, what we might be able to add. So, asei lecha rav. So, we'll start with the comment of the Rambam. The Rambam says, even if he's not worthy. Amazing. Everybody has to have a teacher, a rabbi. Somebody they can go to in all fields. And sometimes people feel, I don't have any rabbis. They're all, you know, whatever. You have to asei lecha, Rav. You have to find yourself a rabbi, even if the rabbi is not so worthy. We have this idea, Yiftach Bedor, Kishmuel Bedor, every generation, whoever the rabbi is, he has as much authority as the rabbi in the previous generation. Now it's asei lecha. This is a very important point that we often miss. You have to make for yourself a rabbi. No rabbi can be imposed on a person. So halachically, what this generally means, and I don't want to talk about the halachic aspect so much, is only a Sanhedrin, the high court, the Supreme Court, can enforce a ruling. In other words, you're under no obligation to listen to any particular rabbi. The fact that some rabbi says that this is allowed, not allowed, that's very nice. If he's not your rabbi, you have zero obligation to listen. Now, you have to find, you need a rabbi. You'd have to ask the same question to your rabbi. But you get to choose your rabbi. Provided he has to be a little competent. In other words, the Rambam is saying you do the best you can, even if he's not the greatest person in the world. But you choose your rabbi. Rabbis are never imposed on you. And that's an important point. And the rabbi has to, and Rav Shechter used to talk about this a lot. I'll even give you the example. He spoke about it in a sort of, both sides. You know, you have to pick a rabbi who has your lifestyle. You're not going to go, I assume everybody here this morning, for sure for myself, I'm not going to go ask a rabbi a question who's an anti-Zionist about should I live in Israel, even if it's not about Israel. For sure, I'm not going to ask a rabbi who's an anti-Zionist. If I'm having a fight with my parents, I want to go to yeshiva in Israel, my parents don't want to let me, do I have to listen to my parents, right? That's an old halakhic question, right? Because this week's parsha, Ish aviv imo tira bet shabto tai tishmoro. If your parents tell you not to do mitzvah, you don't have to listen. Does that apply to living in Israel? Not so simple. It's a question. So you're not going to ask an anti-Zionist rabbi. That's a ridiculous question to ask him. But I would say you shouldn't even ask your anti-Zionist rabbi a question in the Hilchot Kashrut, because all of Torah is interconnected. It's all perspective. That's how we started. Elu ve'elu, divir olikim chayim, right? Because the Torah is many perspectives, and depending on your perspective, and your perspective is going to be sort of a similar type. What issues do you bring to the table when you address a question? So Rav Shechter used to talk about this a lot. Asei lecha rav, you have to choose a rabbi. And he would say the number one quality that the rabbi has to have is humility, because that's what I said before. That's why the Talmud says we follow Beit Hillel, because he was humble. So you want a rabbi who knows what he knows, and he knows when he has to ask another rabbi, when he has to, it's above his pay grade. So, but the rabbi has to reflect your lifestyle, because otherwise that's ridiculous. So it's very important. And, Rav Shechter, and that's for stringency, lekula ulechumra. He mentioned it in the context of the, when I was at Yeshiva University, who was still in the middle of the huge argument, we spoke about Machloket, unfortunately, about the Eruv in Flatbush, whatever, that's a sad chapter. We've had it here in Toronto. I don't have to tell you, those who live in Toronto, the arguments on the Eruv, unfortunately. So there was a big argument, and many people who carried relied on Reb Menashe Klein in Bor Park. He was the Ungover Rav, a big posting to the Mishnah Halachot. It was a major posig, a tremendous Talmud Chacham. He was in Auschwitz with Elie Wiesel. They grew up together, I think, and they were in Auschwitz together. And but he is he holds views that most people here, all people here, no one who holds his hashkafa would be listening to my class. Let's put it that way. That's fine. That's whatever. That's a whole different world. So he was the one who allowed the Eruv. And I remember Rosh Hashanah saying, listen, if you go to him and ask him all your questions, that's fine. But to pick and choose, you know, this rabbi's leaning in here, this rabbi, what we tend to do, this rabbi, or some people look for rabbis who are strict all the time today. So you shouldn't, he felt it was incorrect to rely on a rabbi who you would generally not rely on in any other issue. So it's very important, asei lecha rav, the rabbi has to reflect your worldview. And that's very important on all matters, even if it's not on that area. The other thing, of course, the rabbi has to, you have to live in the same place as the rabbi. In today's world, it's, we can define, you know, geography is defined a lot different than it used to be. In other words, there's a halacha that aniye ircha chakodmi. When you give charity, you should give to the people in your city first. So that doesn't mean when people live in Thornhill, I live in Toronto in 416, so I should give less to Thornhill than in Toronto. That's not what it means. It means my city, where the people I associate with. So in the time of the Talmud, it meant your city. 400 people in your city, those are the people you worry about. Today, my city means where I went to school, where I was in yeshiva in Israel, I went to yeshiva university in New York, where my kids go. That's my ircha. Ircha is not a geographical thing. At the same time, I don't tell you, Israel and America are different, and the issues are different, and the perspectives are different. I remember once when I was a rabbi, so a young, somebody made aliyah, she was in her early 20s, and she asked me a question about eating gelatin. You know, here the OU, the COR doesn't allow gelatin. Rabbi Moser Grzinski, Puskin gelatin was allowed, and I think, I don't know now, but the Israeli Rabbanut used to rely on that, and they would give a hechsher to gelatin. So she asked me, should she eat? Here she never ate it. I told her, listen, you live in Israel now, get yourself an Israeli rabbi. I can tell you what I think. I can tell you, discuss the issue, where it came from. But it's important to have a rabbi who knows you, who knows your personal situation, and who lives in the same general thing. And I think questions like that, kashrut, you know, I don't understand all the implications. When the Zoom debates came up for having your Pesach Seder on Zoom, so you notice all the people who allowed it were all based in Israel. All the North American rabbis didn't allow it. And I know I'm on a couple of rabbinic groups, and there was lots of discussion. And the general tone was not so much the halakhic issues. They could perhaps yes, perhaps no, get around the halakhic issue. You turn it on before Yontif, whatever. We have security in all the buildings anyways. What's the big deal? It's on. The issue was the implications. What's going to happen next year? What is it going to do to Shabbos in general? And there was a feeling people in Israel didn't have that fear. What would it do to Minyan? If you could say Kaddish online, maybe people will stop going to Minyan. And that was a real fear of rabbis in North America. But that was not a fear so much for rabbis in Israel. There was a feeling that Minyan is more embedded in the culture of the modern Orthodox world, and people would go regardless. So these are issues that, you know, just where you live will frame what you think about a particular issue. So that's a selech harab. You must have a rabbi. It doesn't necessarily have to be, although I think it should be connected to the shul you daven at, but that doesn't have to be. Sometimes you have a teacher you feel very close with, but obviously you have to give, when you're in the shul, you have to follow whatever the rabbi says. That's for sure, even if it's not what your rabbi said. But you can never, I don't know if I mentioned it here, right, if you're not allowed to be more observant than your rabbi. Not to display more observant, that's you, right? That's arrogance, right? The number one thing, being humble. That's what we're talking about today. In machloket, everything, to be humble, right? To sit at the feet of your teachers. So to say, oh, my rabbi, I'm going to stand for Kriyat Torah because there's a stringency. The Maharam of Rutenberg introduced the stringency that people should stand for Kriyat Torah. You see many people learning yeshivas, they stand, but it's not a requirement. You know, I sit, and if the rabbi sits and you have a custom stand, either you sit or don't daven in the shul. Go to another shul. That's a selech harav. You have to respect the rabbi of the shul and to look, you know, I stand and he sits. You know, he's not so religious, the rabbi. I'm more religious. He can't daven in such a shul. Okay. A selech harav. Enough about having a rabbi. I mention it because we live in a generation today where people feel they don't need a rabbi. Everything's on the internet. You send in a question. That's not how halacha works. That was the beginning half of the shir. Elu ve'elu, it's all perspective. That the rabbi doesn't know you, doesn't know where you're coming from. Halacha is an art, like the Ramban says. It's not a science. It's not, this is the law. It's not, it has to interact with your personal life. So therefore, asking, I don't understand the whole thing. You ask a question online and they give you a one-line answer. It's not for me. That's not the way I understand how halacha works. You have to ask a real person. You have to give him, and he has to know who you are, who the person asking. Obviously, some issues are generic, obviously, but when you have a more nuanced, a personal question, so you have to ask the question personally. You can't send it on a chat somewhere. So that's it's important. We need rabbis. See, the same way we need doctors. It's true. You can look up stuff online, and you may be more up on the issue than your rabbi. But that's fine. Share that knowledge with the rabbi, and then discuss the issue. So I think in our generation, especially many shuls don't have rabbis. It's another problem. It's, a selech harav is an important teaching. By the way, what the commentaries point out is a selech harav, you should have one rabbi. Like I said, you shouldn't pick and choose. When you have a question, I'm going to choose this rabbi because I like what he says there. Now, obviously, today, no one rabbi can know everything. So you have a specialist. There are specialists in business law, specialists in kashrut, specialists in technology in halakha. Every field has, those who specialize. So you can't have just one rabbi. You can have a GP, as we call it, your general rabbi, and he consults with the experts. That's fine. But this is regarding how to practice. The commentaries point out that when it comes to learning, right, to analysis, to learning Talmud, whatever, you should always have more than one rabbi. You should have many rabbis, many teachers, not just rabbis, because you want to get different ideas. It's never good to have a narrow perspective where you only learn from one person. When it comes to practical law, you shouldn't go picking and choosing. But when it comes to learning, the wider the net we cast and the more we read, the more things we see, the greater informed, the much better it's going to be. So I say lecha rab, to have one rabbi, that's for sort of for psak halacha. When it comes to learning, have many rabbis. Now, knei lecha chaver, buy a friend, it's expensive. To have friendship costs money. You have to invite them to the weddings. Well, now you don't have to invite them so much, but save a lot of money, whatever. Please God, we should have that, right? It's one of the benefits I hope that will come out of this is that weddings will become a lot smaller and people won't have to mortgage their house to pay for weddings anymore. That would be something nice, but okay, that's a whole other story. But knei lecha chaver means it is true. You have to spend money. Friendship costs money. In other words, it's even if you have to spend money, that's okay. That's okay to have friends. It's sort of o chavruta o mituta. Without friends, we can't live. That's the whole thing. Why social distancing is so hard for people. We're social beings. And the Gemara says, o chavruta o mituta, or friendship or death. And okay, Zoom is a little bit, but people miss it. Not everybody follows this. So thank God most people here are. But because we like friendship, and that's good. And even if we have to pay for it. The commentaries, of course, point out in the time of the Mishnah, the distinction between a selech harav and knei lecha chaver is that a rabbi can't get paid, right? You're not allowed to, everybody knows that. Many people like to are strict on that issue. They don't like to pay rabbis because you're not allowed to get paid for any mitzvah. That's why it's rabbis and doctors are supposed to earn the same salaries because you can't pay a doctor either. A businessman is very nice, supports his family, it's important, it's good, but it's not an inherent mitzvah. It's not an inherent mitzvah to be in business. But medicine and teaching Torah are inherent mitzvah, and in theory, you're not allowed to get paid. I don't want to spend too much time, but we obviously know, I'll say on this issue, it needs really to address it separately. I'll just say one point, and that's that Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva that today it's forbidden to teach Torah and not get paid. I don't know that that applies to some guy giving a one-time class and someone has a job. But I mean, teachers, it's forbidden for someone to say, I'm religious. We live in a totally different society. For whatever reason, the Gemara discusses how we pay rabbis. But, you know, until the Middle Ages, rabbis were not paid. But Rav Moshe Feinstein writes that in our generation, it's the Yetzer Hara for a person to want to teach. He flipped the Gemara totally on its head. But anyway, so that's one distinction. The commentator, Asei Lecha Chaver, Asei Lecha Rav, for free, Upnei Lecha Chaver, and buy a friend. But have you done a Kol Adam Lekav Zchut? We'll finish with this teaching. Judge everybody meritoriously. So this is also not so simple. And the commentator is like a lot of these things, like, you know, like Lashon Hara, the book, the Chafetz Chaim, his sefer on Lashon Hara is basically a book in when you're allowed to teach Lashon Hara. I know in the world out there, sort of viewed, you know, the book about how to refrain from Lashon Hara. Actually, his book is equally, maybe more, about when you have to talk Lashon Hara. When somebody, you're going into business with somebody, and I know the guy you're going into business with is not so great, I have to call you up. I'm obligated to talk Lashon Hara. I'm in a court of law. I'm obligated to talk Lashon Hara. Very often you're obligated. As a matter of fact, I saw last week somebody quoted from one of the major sources that it's a greater sin not to talk Lashon Hara than it is to talk Lashon Hara. I know that's not the way it's normally presented, but at a time when you're supposed to speak, you can really harm people by not getting involved. So having done the Kol Zchut does not mean, oh, everybody's wonderful, I'm going to judge you favorably. The Bar Tanura, first of all, points out that's only if you're not sure. No, you can interpret a person's action in more than one way, so give them the benefit of the doubt. But if you know, we don't give everybody the benefit of the doubt. It's not this blanket thing. Whatever you did, you were right. Otherwise, a person can never grow. If I see somebody doing something wrong, that's in the time of the Mishnah, we were supposed to get involved. We're supposed to tell people, rebuke them. Also doesn't apply so much anymore, but because they aren't going to listen. That's the assumption. The person's not going to listen. Don't rebuke them. So you can't, if you're judging everybody that they're so righteous, you're never going to rebuke them. You're never going to improve. So it means if you're in doubt, give the people the benefit of the doubt. That's really what it means. And I'll say one other idea. Have you done a kol ha'adam, the kav zchut, again, that the man. So the commentaries point out, we all sin. We all do things wrong. We're human beings. When we judge a person, don't judge a person by one thing he did wrong, by one action, by two actions. Judge the person in totality. This person is a good person with faults, and that's okay. That's normal. If you don't have faults, you're not human. It isn't true. But so have you done a kol ha'adam? That when you see something that somebody did something really wrong, it can be still really wrong, but it doesn't mean the whole person is terrible. I think this comes up very often, even in sometimes people do terrible, really, I mean, Mish is talking about people sin, you know, regular sins. Sometimes people do horrendous sins. People do, like, you know, abuse and all kinds of terrible things. It doesn't mean that that person has done no good in their life. You know, we tend to judge people, they're good or bad, evil or, and we know in psychology, we do that a lot. We judge people, you know, they're good, they're bad, and then we confirmation bias. We interpret what they do with our preconceived notions of they're good or bad. And I think the Judaism wants us to understand the complexity. It's kol ha'adam. Man is a complex being with good and bad. And even people who do evil, really evil, can do good. And we have to, maybe overall they're evil, they're worse. Okay, fine. We don't judge them lekav zchut. I said it's not for everybody. So again, it's all these things require nuance and sensitivity and apply. So just let me do a very quick review of what we learned today. We started discussing a machloket, if machloket is good or bad. Elu ve'elu, they're both the words of the living God, or it's mean people don't pay attention. And we basically said Judaism is an art, not a sign, so you're going to have different interpretations. So we're arguing on ideas, that's very good. If the argument promotes love and friendship like it did between between Hillel and Shammai, it's good. But if it doesn't, then it's not Neshem Shammai. I didn't mention Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. The Gemara is a horrible story that the students of Beit Shammai actually murdered. I hate to say it, but it's in the Yerushalmi, that they actually murdered some of the students of Beit Hillel. And that's If you accept that it's a little bit debate about that, that's obviously why you wouldn't include Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, at least that generation, in the machloket, the Shem Shemayim, because often religious disputes, as I alluded to, become the most intense and the most worst, and it's very dangerous. And that's why the rabbis want to emphasize the negative sides of machloket and cause division. But there is place, not on factual stuff, not on history, but on ideas. And if it promotes warmship, a machloket is very good. Then we discuss opening your house both to scholars and to wisdom in general, because that's more important than formal. Informal education is more important than camps that are being like canceled now. Often the kids learn much more. It's a much more stronger Jewish thing, the informality, than the formal, the schooling we get. So we welcome people into our house. And then not only scholars, we all welcome everybody into our house, especially poor people into us, a discussion with changing nature of women, how much, you know, the interaction and where do we cross the line between sort of, you know, how much socialization is good and wonderful and needed and how much isn't. And then the importance of having a rabbi. You can argue with the rabbi, of course, the notion of being humble, but it's important to have a rabbi who reflects your worldview. You don't pick and choose, but for ideas, we have many rabbis. Important, a friendship, and to judge people, not just, he's wonderful, but to judge people fairly and accurately and to understand we all sin. We're all complex people, but we should look in totality. Hopefully we are wonderful people. Okay, I want to wish everybody well. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Like I say, without students, aselech harab, but a rab needs talmidim. So I greatly appreciate all who come, especially on a Friday morning. Sunday morning, Rabbi Adam Mintz will be starting his series at 11 a.m. We have classes on next week, of course, so I want to wish everybody well. Hopefully to see you online, and Shabbat Shalom, everybody. Thank you.
Shabbat Shalom.
Sorry, you know what? I see there are a couple questions here. Those who are still here.